So I may have turned off the... Okay. So I'll just briefly go through it now, so also because I do want to have time to get at least some of the ideas from the end of the last lecture that we didn't get to. High road and low road is a way of distinguishing two broad strategies that firms adopt in order to compete. So that's the nature of a market economy. That's one of its virtues, is that market economies encourages competition, which leads to various strategies on the part of firms. Sometimes these strategies are virtuous. You get innovations that improve products, that improve the quality of life for people. But sometimes the strategies which firms adopt because of competition are destructive. We've observed that, for example, in our exploration of environmental externalities. The strategies of firms that are just behaving normally, they're trying to maximize their profits under competitive conditions, is to externalize the costs of environmental sustainability, to externalize pollution, to impose those costs on the environment, because that makes it cheaper to produce their products, and therefore they can compete more advantageously. So competition is good. It's one of the things that drives an economy forward dynamically, but it can lead you down the low road, a road where you produce all sorts of costs on the society and on other people. Or it can move along the high road, where you adopt strategies that are continually improving the conditions. Not because that's your goal, remember. The goal of the firm is just to maximize their profits. But there are circumstances in which that's the best way to do it. The best way to do it is to improve the quality of work, to improve the loyalty of your workers, to enhance their training, and so on. Well, let's just go down this list to give you a stylized account of these two kinds of firms, so you'll have this idea clearly in mind. First, the basis of firm competition. In the low road, it's primarily on price. Make things as cheap as possible. High road, competitive strategies compete primarily on quality. Let's make products as good as possible and as attractive as possible to consumers. So we'll compete mainly on quality and less on price. Now, of course, it's not the case that when you compete on quality, you don't care at all about price, but that becomes less of the central driving idea of your competition. The product market for low road capitalism is typically mass goods that are very homogeneous. You can produce lots of them of exactly the same sort. High road capitalism is centered around producing specialized and more customized goods. The jobs in low road capitalism are characteristically highly specialized, very detailed divisions of labor. Whereas in high road capitalism, the typical jobs have multitasks. They involve a fair amount of variety. In again, a stylized way, in the low road, skills are low. Frederick Taylor, a famous industrial relations engineer of the early 20th century, who was one of the theorists that developed the idea of the assembly line and how to organize it with maximum efficiency, he said the ideal was to reduce the skill level of workers to the point that they would be basically trained guerrillas. The caricature of an assembly line where all day long you twist one bolt, you know, and a human being becomes essentially like a robot. That was his ideal, because that would be the most efficient way of producing under these low road conditions. Under high road, the typical skill level is high. This means that in low road firms, job training is very short. It's very much directed towards the specifics of the job to be done and provided by the employers. The training process for high road jobs and high road firms requires lifetime training and retraining. It's provided jointly by employers and various kinds of public institutions. Various kinds of training opportunities outside of the firm, but also by the firm. And the idea in high road firms is that training is an ongoing and permanent feature of employment, not a one-shot thing at the beginning just to enable you to do the minimally skilled jobs. Job autonomy is low in low road firms and high. People have much more control over the character of their, how they spend their time, the intensity that they work at any given moment. Whereas in low road firms, there's very little self-control over work. Low road firms typically have a rigid differentiation between managers and workers with many managerial layers. They tend to be very hierarchically organized. Whereas high road firms have low differentiation of managers and workers with relatively few layers. And finally, this is of course the punchline that's reflected in the other charts we've looked at. Low road firms have relatively low wages and high road firms relatively high wages. Well, this is a stylized character description. Lots of firms will have some high road jobs and many low road jobs, and probably most high road firms have some low road jobs, so to speak. Google is thought of as a high road firm in these terms. If you go down this list, for most of the jobs within Google, these criteria would be met. But I suspect, I don't know, I haven't studied Google in particular, but I suspect that there are things like janitorial services in Google, which they probably subcontract to a janitorial firm rather than do in-house, but in which the jobs are still low-road jobs with unpleasant working conditions and insecurity and low wages, I suspect. But perhaps not. It's possible that Google, because it has so much resources, it's so profitable as a firm, that they can afford even to be generous and flexible towards their janitorial staff. Perhaps, but I don't know. Other firms like Walmart are notorious for having really fitting all these low-road characteristics. More recently, Walmart has actually begun to recognize that there are problems that they face by virtue of being so relentlessly concerned with de-skilling and rendering their employees insecure and vulnerable. Walmart was famous a decade or so ago for helping its employees fill out applications for food stamps because their wages were not sufficient to provide a living wage for families. You know, so basically, it was part of their strategy to pay low wages and then get the government to make up the difference in the form of food stamps. Well, more recently, Walmart has realized that the low level of customer, of employee satisfaction, the very high rates of turnover, were actually beginning to impinge on their ability to compete, and they've tried to at least improve to some extent their employee relations. Partially, this was also in response to efforts that were beginning for employees of Walmart stores to unionize. And once the threat of unionization occurs, then some firms improve conditions simply as a way of trying to undercut the move for unionization. Well, here's the stylized picture. Most people, I think, if you ask, would you rather have an economy in which the basic way in which work is organized and the strategies of firms develop is low road or high road? I think most people would say the quality of life and the character of our communities would be better if we had a high road economy rather than a low road economy. Well, why don't we? What's the problem? If we are currently following the low road because of an era of deregulation and letting employers just do whatever they wanted, how should we think about the problem of moving from the low road to the high road? Well, first of all, let me just draw a little picture. These pictures are what are called stylized pictures, right? There's no data here. I'm just trying to show you the character of the connection. And If you were actually to put data, it would be more complicated. But this is as an expositional strategy to help clarify the nature of the argument. So the basic idea of the low road and high road is that it's possible for firms to be pretty profitable either by relentlessly pushing skills down, paying as little as possible. That's one way to be profitable. That locks you into that whole structure on the previous chart. With low skills, low wages, low autonomy, high supervision, competing on cost, not on quality. But you can also be very profitable by paying high wages. But only if you pay high wages and then adopt all those other elements of the high road strategy. Competing on quality, creating autonomy for workers, having less supervision, doing all the other things that make for a high quality work setting where, with high levels of commitment on the part of employees. If you're in the left-hand zone of this picture, if you're in this part of the picture here, if, let's suppose you are right here and you want to increase profits, you can do two things. You could try to move all the way over to here, or you could just keep pushing on de-skilling. And that's the basic problem. If you are in this left-hand part of the graph, even if you were kind of in the middle, right? So your firm was sort of below average skills, but it wasn't completely de-skilled. And then competitive pressures increase. And deregulation often does increase competitive pressures, especially if deregulation exposes you to international competition. Well, that tends, if you're here, the easy strategy to compete is to move in this direction. But what if you're here? What if you're a firm that's located here, to the right of that bottom point? You're kind of on the higher skill level in terms of your labor force, and then competition increases and you want to increase your profits. Well, skill enhancement would be the natural strategy. It's harder if you're on the left-hand side of the curve to jump all the way over to here. There's more distance, more work to be done. This idea can be described as a transition trough. And here's the basic idea. And this applies to all sorts of interesting circumstances. If you're on one kind of system, in this case it's the low road, and we're looking at time here. So the horizontal axis is time. You're on the low road, and we're trying to ask the question, how well are you able to compete in international competition? So you're a low road firm, and suddenly you're competing with firms in China. International competition has increased. You've deregulated the international market. You have more unfettered free trade between firms producing clothing or furniture or whatever in North America and firms in China. And you have adopted a low road strategy. And you're finding that your ability to compete is declining over time. It's declining over time because you're competing with even lower low road strategies of firms abroad. Well, what, and you say, well, in the long term, I can't compete on the low road. Eventually, if you stay on the low road, you're going to disappear because you can't compete with the low wages in China. And you ask yourself, well, what if I switched to the high road? What if I started, instead of producing with low skill, changed our technologies, changed our strategy, compete on quality, and produce with high skill? Well, the problem is that to switch from one to the other itself is costly. So that the pathway, the time path between the low road and the high road doesn't just jump off. You know, you don't just switch instantaneously and suddenly you're on the high road. No, it's a transition between the low road and the high road. And that transition is costly. And because it's costly, during the period of transition, you're actually doing worse than you'd be doing if you stayed on the low road. You get the idea? You could stay on the low road and eventually things are going to prove that you can't continue. But if you try to go from the low road to the high road, you have this period where things are costly, where it takes time to retrain people, to develop the routines for the new technologies. And this gap is called the transition trough. And the transition trough is such that even if firms want to switch from the low road to the high road, they find it difficult to do so. It's costly. That's the transition trough problem. That's one of the obstacles to moving from the low road to the high road. A second obstacle we've already talked about. This was the training deficit trap, the free riding problem of providing training to your workers. This is something we discussed in lecture 4. It's a classic free riding problem. I won't go through it again in detail, but the basic idea is it's costly to provide really good quality training to your workers, especially training that's portable. That is teaching what are called, or training workers in what are called meta skills, the skill to learn skills, giving them this general training, which is really what makes for a flexible, high-skilled worker. Flexible, high-skilled workers are workers that easily acquire new skills as needed, because training is an iterative process that goes on indefinitely. Well, this is the free rider problem, the collective action problem around training, which we discussed then. It costs you a lot to produce it. Isn't it better if you don't train your own workers and you just poach workers from other firms? Let other firms provide the training. Then you can offer higher wages than those other firms because you haven't borne the costs of those training. You can poach them without bearing the costs. Well, every firm thinks this way, and nobody produces the training. That's a free rider problem in the provision of training. That's another reason why, in a deregulated economy, where training responsibilities are assigned entirely to firms, where community colleges and other public institutions and public forms of coordinating the problem of training by providing systems of apprenticeships with public subsidies to provide the resources needed for an extended period of this kind of ongoing training, where those aren't provided because that's government interference with the market. So if you have a deregulated labor market and a deregulated structure of training, you'll get a training deficit, which is a trap. It locks you into the low road. Finally, and this is, I am sure, the most controversial idea that we propose in this chapter of the book, there's also what could be called the anti-union trap. So here's another stylized graph. This shows the relationship between the strength of worker organization and participation. How much power do workers have within a organization of production? And the competitiveness of the firm. And again, you see there are two high points. The best way to be competitive is to have very weak worker organization. That gives you the greatest flexibility. If you're an owner and manager of a firm and you want to just change technologies, reorganize work, pay whatever wages you want or can, the best thing is to not have to bother with the collective organization of workers. If you have a completely disorganized labor force in which you only have to deal individually with each individual worker, you offer them a labor contract, they can take it or leave it, but you don't have to deal with them as a collective body, that's way easier, certainly easier. And it's the strategy that involves the highest level of competitiveness. But there is another high point. It may not be as high. This is actually a debate among people who argue around these things. Some people argue that the right-hand maximum, this point here, actually should be up here, that you can have extremely competitive, well-organized firms with very strong unions. If they're very strong, you get real collaboration between employers and labor. They work together to make the firm competitive. My own sense is that, yes, you can do really well at this point. A very highly organized firm with a strong union that basically forces the employer to engage in collaborative problem solving rather than unilateral problem solving can be a very competitive firm, but probably not as competitive as a completely disorganized. So I think that the shape of this curve looks like this. It's pretty tough to get real data. There is data to show that it has this curvilinear character, that there is a dip in the middle and then it goes back up. It's hard to know exactly how high it would rise. Well, if that's the general model, this is called a model, for those of you who want to know. And underlying this model, there's all sorts of equations. If you like that kind of thing, you can create formal mathematical representations. But basically, it's just this story that I've told. By the way, that's just something for you to know. For those of you who are studying economics, essentially the process is people have in their heads an understanding, an intuitive understanding of how they think the world works. They draw a picture of how they think the world works. And then they ask the question, what are the equations that would make the world look like this? It's not really that the equations answer the question, how does the world work? Rather, they figure out, usually through kind of casual theoretical thinking and intuition, how they think the world works. And then they ask, what are the equations that would make it look like that? It's a kind of ask-backward way of thinking about how you develop theory, but it's pretty typical. It's not just for economists. That's a typical way that theoretical ideas get developed. All right, enough of that. Here's the United States. We're on the low end internationally on the strength of unions. When you're at this point in the curve, and you want to increase competitiveness, well, once again, the temptation is, aha, we're losing out to international competition, unions are a pain in the ass, let's destroy unions. Let's make them even weaker. The United States has among the weakest unions in comparably developed capitalist countries, and the strategy of employers to deal with pressures of competition is typically to try to make them even weaker. That was certainly the source of the big controversy in Wisconsin over the last 6 years, especially 6 years ago, at exactly this time in 2011, when the initial act of the Walker administration to destroy public sector unions occurred. And that was followed a few years later by legislation to try to destroy private sector unions by changing the rules under which labor unions could collect dues within their work settings. Again, there's a problem of a transition trough. If you're here and you want to increase competitiveness, moving towards the high road is harder. You have to traverse this gap, this trough at the bottom. And indeed, the strategy in recent years to increase competitiveness has been to make things even worse with respect to the role of unions. Now, the role of unions are important for the high road in many countries because they block low road strategies. All right, so remember, the slogan is pave the high road, close off the low road. Well, how are you going to close off the low road? You need some form of power that obstructs the spontaneous strategy of employers to degrade work, to lower wages, to de-skill their employees. You need some power source that's going to block that strategy. That's the close off the low road. Pave the high road, close off the low road. And unions in many countries are one of the institutions that provides that collective power needed to obstruct the unilateral action of employers. Well, solutions, what to do? Well, I've given the slogans, close off the low road. I think closing off the low road has two crucial components in the American case. One is to create a high minimum wage. The minimum wage in the United States today in real dollars, if you adjust for inflation, is lower than it was at the end of the 1960s. If the minimum wage, we'll discuss this when we look at persistent poverty in the United States. That'll be a topic in a couple of weeks. If the minimum wage in the United States had kept up with productivity growth, with inflation, it would be about $12 or $15 an hour now. If it had kept up with productivity growth, it would be about $23 an hour. That is, if the minimum wage had just tracked, had been set in 1968, and just grew at the same rate of productivity in the economy as a whole, the minimum wage in the United States would be about, will be over $20 an hour now. Now, what happens when you have a high minimum wage is it blocks the low road. If you have a high minimum wage, you just can't pursue the low road. It doesn't mean you can't have a successful competitive strategy, it just can't be a low road strategy. And firms that could only survive with the low road then disappear. That's what happens when you have a high minimum wage. That's been the strategy of in other countries which have tried to avoid the low road, try to avoid this polarization in the labor market. They simply make it difficult and ultimately impossible for firms to successfully compete by depressing wages and reducing skills. And then firms have to adapt. They have to adopt other kinds of strategies. Close off the low road by a high minimum wage and other reforms that are connected to the labor market of that character. And labor law reform to facilitate rebuilding unions rather than labor laws to accelerate the destruction of unions. And then pave the high road. That's the complement to closing off the low road. The transition trough traps, if you have firms that really want to modernize, that really want to adopt new technologies and new ways of work, these require subsidization to make the transition process possible for those firms, rather than leaving that up to the market. And the training deficit trap requires extensive public involvement in training, rather than leaving this primarily to the activities and initiatives of the firms themselves. Okay, well, we have a little bit of time. I'd like to zip back to the end of the last lecture and go through the financial crisis. You all have lived through this. This is part of your own historical memory, even though, you know, some of you were early preteens, I suppose. You were 10 or 11 years old for some of you when it happened. Others were a bit older. But it's part of your awareness that the United States, in the last decade, went through the most severe economic crisis that we've had since the 1930s. Well, how did this come about? It's anchored in the nature of the housing market, but that isn't really that's the site of where the problems really intensified. But the fact that they intensified there reflects a deeper transformation of the American economy that made the housing market so vulnerable to the kind of disruptions that we saw in the Great Recession. The deeper issue were these trends in financialization of the economy as a whole, where finance becomes the driving source of economic growth, rather than developing our real capacity to produce goods and services. Well, the housing market is organized around a number of things. First, mortgage loans. That's just a way that people can borrow money in order to buy a house. Most people can't save up enough to buy a house. If you want to buy a house, what you do is you get a mortgage. Mortgages, of course, have risks because you may not be able to pay back the mortgage or pay your monthly interest rates, your payments to the holder of that mortgage loan. And those risks lead, if they become intense, to foreclosures. A key part of the housing market crisis and the way it produced a financial crisis had to do with this problem of financial innovation, which I explained very briefly last time, this notion of derivatives. Basically, the idea is this. If you're a bank or a mortgage lending institution and you issue mortgages, you have a lot of people who come in your door, you say, yeah, I'll lend you $300,000 to buy a house. Here, sign the paper, and you give them the $300,000. They buy the house, and they owe you $300,000 plus interest payments on it. That's how mortgages work, right? So you get a whole bunch of these mortgages, and then you say, I don't want to handle these mortgages. I don't want to hold them. I'm going to sell these mortgages to somebody else so that they will hold the mortgages. They will receive the interest payments, and I can then use the resources I've obtained by giving them the mortgages, selling the mortgages to them. I can issue more mortgages. That's called a derivative, when you package together a bunch of mortgages and then sell them as a package to other people. The typical way this was done was by combining mortgages that had a high risk of foreclosure with mortgages that had an extremely low risk. You mixed them up. You didn't just sell a package of very low risk mortgages and a package of very high risk mortgages. Rather, you mixed them up. Now, the idea was, by mixing them up, you reduce the overall level of risk. You reduce the overall level of risk because they kind of balanced each other out. Those were called mortgage-backed securities, and that's a particular example of a derivative. A derivative is some financial asset that's derived from other assets in one way or another. Okay, mortgage-backed securities were a big deal. It was a big deal because of another innovation, which was called subprime mortgages. A prime mortgage is a mortgage that you give to somebody who earns a steady income, certainly sufficient to cover the interest payments, and you sell them the mortgage and you have great confidence that they'll be able to pay for the interest payments on it, barring some catastrophe in their lives. A subprime mortgage is a mortgage you give to somebody pretty much expecting that there's a pretty good chance they will default on the loan, and then you'll get the house back. Now, why would you do that? Why would you sell people mortgages, give them loans, with the expectation that they will default? Probably, you know, not that for sure. How? Why would you do that? Well, one reason you do it is if you think that the price of the house is going to go up, you might even hope they default, right? They default on it, what do you get? You get a house worth more than when they took out the loan. They have to give you the house because they can't pay the loan. Then you can sell the house. You foreclose, they give you the house, you got an asset that's now worth more than the mortgage that you gave them. Subprime mortgages typically had the following character, and this is really where it gets kind of creepy, even nasty. You walk into my bank, I say, look, I'm going to give you this mortgage with an introductory interest rate that's really low. You can definitely pay it. It's 4% a year interest. And you can have that at 4% a year for 3 years, for 4 years, whatever. After that point, the interest rate will be adjusted to whatever is the prevailing interest rate at the time. So you look at your income. Yeah, I can pay a 3 or 4% interest rate. And 4 or 5 years down the road, if it jumps up to 10%, well, I couldn't pay that. But because my house value will have increased, because the house price will go up, because that's what everybody says, it's going to go up, I could then refinance my mortgage because I have a more valuable house that I'm owning, right? I could refinance it and get another low interest rate. So the idea was you seduce people into getting a mortgage with low introductory interest rates, and they expect to be able to continually pay at a low interest rate because they expect to be able to refinance their homes. It's a pretty good scheme, as long as it is true that the price of houses continues to go up. That's the background assumption. The price of houses have to keep going up in order for that strategy to make sense for the buyer of the home. And this comes then to the last point as the kind of general parameters of this problem. people buy houses not just to live in them, but in order to speculate in the value of the real estate. Speculative markets. You buy a house to flip it. And then you combine that with derivatives. So we got two things going on here. People are buying derivatives because they think these are really good assets to hold. And people are buying houses in order to sell them, not to live in them. Speculative markets and houses, plus derivatives that have all these subprime mortgages in them. It all works great so long as profits keep going up. Well, let's look at what happened. Here's real housing prices in the United States between 1901 and 2013. Now, this is a pretty amazing time series. Between 1901 and World War I, housing prices, the index here is set at in the year 2000 at 100. So this is not in dollars, this is just an index. It's set at 100 and then everything is relative to that. We have a pretty stable rate at about 80% of what it was in 2000, between 1901 and 1916. From the entry of the United States into World War I until after World War II, housing prices drop and they're basically lower than they were in the pre-World War II period. Then there's a big jump after World War II. That's when the big economic boom comes, the GI Bill. GIs come back from the war, they get college educated, the economy is booming. There is a big increase in prices of houses from right after the war until the early 1950s. A couple of years of very rapid house price increases, driven by a very high demand for housing. But once the developer industry for building new houses gets into full gear, notice that between 1947 and 1996, really, house prices are pretty stable when you adjust for inflation. There are ups and downs. There are little blips in the late 70s and another little blip in the late 80s, but it doesn't really go over anywhere. And none of those little blips going up accelerate into a bubble. But look what happens in around 2000. We get this extraordinary rise in price houses, the price of housing, really unprecedented, and then a complete collapse. The collapse occurs because people who bought all these subprime mortgages, in the expectation that housing prices will keep going up forever, then this gets fueled by the derivative market, where the derivative market becomes so hot that people who are issuing the individual mortgages realize they're not taking any risks at all by giving mortgages to people who can't possibly pay them back, because they are able to offload those mortgages on the secondary market. They can package them up and sell them to others. And furthermore, who's buying these packages of derivatives? Banks, among other things, the big banks are buying them. Why? Because they are able to invest. Remember, the barrier between commercial banks and investment banks has disappeared. Banks are able to buy all these securities because they're good investments. They're getting high rates of return. And then what happens is that the economy begins to slow down. We're heading into what could have been just a mild recession, but then all these subprime mortgages begin to default. And that ripples through derivatives. The key innovation was the derivatives market. The result was a rapid growth in subprime mortgages, among other instruments. Investment banks got heavily into the speculative market. Hey, we can make a lot of money doing this. There were all sorts of derivatives. I've just given you one. And then, here's another twist, something called, I'm not getting the technical name. It's basically, if you bought a derivative, you could also buy an insurance policy against the derivative losing value. So you had these insurance swaps around assets, which added another layer of complication. Big speculative markets,
The speculation becomes increasingly leveraged. Remember, leverage, you borrow money in order to buy derivatives. Oh, we're really getting on shaky ground now. Derivatives are giving you returns of 10 or 15% a year. What if I borrow, you know, $100,000 at a 5% a year in order to buy derivatives that are returning 10% a year? I get a 5% clear profit on other people's money. I'm not having to, it's borrowed money. You leverage the speculation. When prices then begin to start to decline, the whole structure unravels, beginning with the complete collapse of a very long-standing, respected bank, Lehman Brothers Bank. And this triggered knock-on effects. As Lehman Brothers collapsed, then other banks that had lent Lehman Brothers large sums of money so Lehman Brothers could borrow, could buy derivatives and other things, then they began to be shaky. And there was a point in which there was a fear that the entire finance system could completely implode. And that's what triggered the bailout. Paying off these gigantic banks, because if they were to fail, it would freeze up the entire economy. And by freeze up, I mean the following. You're a manufacturing firm. You have good products. They're selling well. But every month, you have to borrow money briefly to pay the wages of your workers, because the flow of your income comes periodically. It's not smooth. And to smooth out your payments of payroll, banks typically borrow at the beginning of every month what is needed for payroll, and then as they get revenues in, they pay back those loans. Very short-term loans. Well, if banks completely collapse, you can't get even the short-term loans. So the manufacturing firm can't pay its workers. And so it also runs into difficulties. The magnitude of the crisis. Briefly run through some of this data. This is foreclosures per 1,000 owner-occupied dwellings, beginning in the year 2000. A huge increase in foreclosures. Here is the employment losses, and this is indexed at 100%. So if you begin with each of these recessions and say, at the beginning, we have 100% employment, the beginning of the recession. How long does it take to get back to where you started in terms of employment? And how far below that 100% level do you hit at the bottom? Well, the 2000 recession took way longer to recover than any of the previous recessions since 1980. And note that each subsequent recession is taking longer and longer to recover from. This makes one think that the system as a whole is becoming more vulnerable. Right? If you didn't know anything about what's going on and you saw this graph and you saw that there was a recession in 1981, 1990, 2001, and 2007, and that each recession takes more longer and longer before you get back the number of jobs that were destroyed in the economic downturn, that might make you feel there's something changed in the character of the system. It's getting more and more vulnerable rather than more and more robust. Now, this is another chart, slightly different point. This is the weeks that the average number of weeks of those currently unemployed in different periods of recession. The recession periods are the gray areas. And the expansion periods, that is when jobs are being created, are the white periods. And again, this last recession is unlike anything that we've had in recent years, recent decades. Financial profits as a percentage of the total profits of domestic corporations, of course, took a huge hit in the financial collapse. You can see they dropped from around 20% of all profits to minus 20%. The financial sector really lost dramatically. But look how quickly it came back, just as before. A huge collapse producing masses of foreclosures, producing a recession that lasted longer than any recession in recent decades, with longer spells of unemployment, but financial profits recovered very quickly. And not only financial profits, but look at this graph. This is the New York City securities industry average bonuses. These are the average bonuses that employees in New York who work for Wall Street in the securities industry, the average bonuses they get. So in 2006, the average bonus was over $200,000. That's the average bonus. In 2007, it was about $200,000. It does drop in 2008. That's the worst year of the recession. But it gets right back up there pretty quickly. And one can hardly argue, looking at this, that people who worked in the finance sector as a whole really suffered as a result of the risk profiles of their own investment activities that then led to such an enormous disruption of the economic structure. They were able to protect themselves and did. This was pretty scandalous in 2009 when there were these gigantic bonuses that were given to the finance who were the leaders of finance who were basically turning the bailout, substantial parts of the bailout money, which was needed to keep them from collapsing, turning them into bonuses for themselves. And that really made people kind of disgusted at the banking system. All right, what can be done? Got 2 minutes, I'll just give you the list. First, strengthen and enforce Dodd-Frank regulations. These were the regulations set in place after the collapse to try to reduce the riskiness of the whole system, to deal with the too big to fail problem by having greater regulations on these giant banks. Strengthen and enforce Dodd-Frank regulations rather than eliminate them, which seems to be the current impulse in Washington. End too big to fail. Break up the monster banks. Break them up because they can't really be regulated effectively. And they can't be regulated effectively because they're too powerful. Because they're so powerful, they can subvert regulations because they can control the regulatory process through all sorts of means. The only way to deal with the too big to fail problem, that is banks that are so large that if they fail, they would devastate the rest of the economy, is either to very strongly regulate them or to break them up. And I think in the end, ultimately, because the power concentration is so large, they really do need to be broken up. And finally, we need to build a more community-rooted finance system where the central purpose of credit and finance is to facilitate the lives of ordinary people and their communities, rather than finance having as its central purpose to increase the wealth of the already wealthy. We need a finance system that's anchored in community and oriented to community. Now that's a placeholder for new institutions. It's a central problem for the next decades of the 21st century to figure out how to build such institutions for our economy. Have fun on Thursday, and I'll see you next Tuesday.